The city of New Orleans lost a legend this year with the passing of Edgar Dookie Chase, Jr. Co-proprietor of the dining landmark Dookie Chase's Restaurant, his impact was felt in the culinary world, the civil rights movement, and the music community. Perhaps most significant was his impact on his family and his wife of 70 years, Leah Chase. We sat down with Leah at Dookie Chase's Restaurant to discuss Dookie's life and legacy and the role he played in making Leah Chase the icon she is today.
When I met Dookie, well, you know, he was with the music. He was a musician. And the funny thing about it is I never liked musicians. Well, he met me at a dance. He was up on the stage directing his band. And he told everybody, I'm going to dance with that girl. They said, are you not? She's got to dance with you. So, sure enough, and then I came around and met his mother, and we could relate to the families were almost all alike. You know, all the so-called Creoles of color lived almost the same kind of life. You know, they worked every day, they cooked, they sewed, and that's what I did, sewed more than cooked. I didn't start cooking until I came in this restaurant. So, and it went on from there, and then we got married.
How did Mr. Chase ask you to marry him? You've never told me this before.
No, I never did, because it was just, you know, back in those days, you didn't have all the formality that you have today. You just know, well, we're going to get married. So we just went off and got married, you know. And that was so funny, because he was only 18 years old and I was 23. Here we go off and get married. And when we come back, everybody said, oh, told my mother-in-law, this girl is just going to ruin your business. But my mother-in-law she wasn't like that. She was a nice lady, and she really was. She loved this business. And she always said, Leah, you're just like me. What she meant was our lifestyles were like, she loved this business, I love this business. She truly loved her husband, and I truly loved Dookie. Then his daddy died. His daddy was a young man. His daddy was only 57 years old.
Wow.
And when Dookie died, when Big Dookie died, well, my mother-in-law had nobody else. So he had to come in here and work.
He didn't really have a choice. It was what he had to do.
He had no choice. It's what he had to do. And I always felt sorry for Dookie, because if you live your life and you're doing something you don't like to do, that's not happiness at all. But he did it.
But he did it for the family.
He did it for his mother. The family was big for him. And he did it for the family, and he did it well.
Well, I never knew that he ever worked behind the bar here.
He was a good bartender, and I didn't drink a thing. Never drank and never smoked. And I think that's why he couldn't relate to that music world. Because when he got, as much as he loved it, he knew the life of a musician was not easy. It is not an easy life. Particularly in the days that he came through, it was a hard life, a rough life. He used to sit right here and wait for people to come in, and they would talk, and he would talk about his music. He would sing to them and play his music. Then he ran this, he took a course by mail from Cornell University, learned how to manage this business, learn all that. Then he went off to promoting bands. He had top-notch musicians. They went with King Cole, Lionel Hampton, Duke Ellington. They went with big bands. I'll never forget, he was the first one in 1953, the first African-American promoter to go into the Municipal Auditorium.
Really?
Mm-hmm. It was segregation, so blacks couldn't sit with whites, and blacks couldn't sit downstairs. We had to always sit upstairs at the auditorium. so that he had sold out all upstairs.
Oh.
And nothing downstairs. And he was about to lose his $5,000, and you know, with Dookie, that wasn't going too well. He didn't want to lose that money. So overnight, the white stood behind the tickets. They sold the whole show out. We had to put people on the stage. In the show, biggest show of 1951. So he did a lot. And people didn't know that because he was so low-key about what he did and how he did it. He used to work for the NAACP at that time. He would go all down in the Ninth Ward, get members. We got to have everybody join the NAACP, work with Thurgood Marshall, work with a man from here named Nathaniel Byrd, Dutch Boreal, A.P. Turo, all those people, Ernest Wright. But, you know, he just did what he had to do.
But he was then responsible, I believe, for all of the people, the politicians, the members of the NAACP, the people who were moving to end segregation.
He was
the one gathering them here.
He would gather them here. King, I'll never forget. See, that's when I used to go home at night. He would bring King in here. They would come in here at night, talk to Dookie. There was a man named Jim Dombrowski. He was an old guy who went to the Highlander School in Tennessee. And the Highlander School would train people to be nonviolent protesters. So I met Jim Dombrowski, and Dookie met him by working with the sugar workers here. I remember Domino Sugar. They met upstairs to form unions for these sugar workers, and that was Jim Dombrowski's thing.
Come gather around, people, wherever you roam, and admit that the waters around you have grown.
You know, when I came along, this is not what I came to do. I came to push him up and ride his coattail. But it didn't work that way, Poppy. See, his daddy would go out here, his mother would push and do this. That's what I thought he would do. But he wasn't that way. So I had to push out. I had to go push out, do what I had to do to make it.
Come writers and critics, prophesize with your pen, and keep your eyes wide, the chance won't come again.
And his thing was always to take care of his family. His whole thing was, after he got so sick, was to be sure he left me and his children without any debt. That was his big things. Now, you know, I'm a different kind of person. I could owe the world. And whoever pay for it, pay for it. Not Dookie. Not Dookie. He was always there to say, look, now you can't spend this money. You can't do this. And that's going to be one thing I'm going to miss. Because he kept everything in order, everything straightened out.
You all were married for 70 years.
70 years. 70 years we lived with people who said we were not going to make it.
What was the secret to that 70-year marriage?
The hardest thing about making a marriage work is women have to be almost superwomen, Poppy. Everybody can't do that, and every man is not going to be the same way. Dookie was a good man, easy man, and you know, but I never tried to run over him. I never did that. As many awards as I get, and he was appreciative of it, but I never tried to overpower him. If you're a woman that has to go out front like I had to do to hold this business together, to make this business move, if he wasn't outgoing, then I had to be outgoing. You might not think that, man, like people who never saw Dookie, you know, and I used to kid about that. Well, they say, well, Leah, why is always Dookie's name here? I said, look, I'm not stupid, you know. Dookie's name stay up there where all the bills go to Dookie. He pay all the bills. They don't come to Leah. He pay all the bills.
Oh, the day after Mr. Chase passed, I knew just where you'd be.
Right in
the
kitchen. When I lost Emily, Emily died at about 1 o'clock in the morning. I had to open this place up, so I came in here. When my mother died, I had to open this place up. When Dookie died, I had to open this place up. That's not easy.
No.
It's not easy.
It keeps you going.
But it keeps me going. So I'm going to keep working. That's what I have to do for Dookie. I have to keep working for my children. I have to keep working for the city I live in. And I hope Dookie will look down on me and say, well, honey, you're doing it. You're making it work.
Leah Chase of Dookie Chase Restaurant.